at 1:35, and you have present myself, Betty Davis, and co-chair Thomas, Senator Thomas. We also have online Senator Calgary, and we were expecting one other person to come before we finish the meeting. But in order to stay on time, we're going to go ahead and have the sponsor of SJR 11 come forward, give his testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to give a quick presentation on Senate Joint Resolution number 11. This is a simple but critical resolution which urges the United States Congress to ensure adequate funding for veterans' health care. This is a resolution that the veterans groups in Alaska have been asking for. There are a number of other states across the United States that are that have enacted this resolution or a similar type of resolution. As we all know, the United States Department of Veterans Affairs provides medical care for veterans who have risked their lives to protect the security of our nation. The department provides a wide range of specialized services to meet the unique needs of veterans, including treatment for care for spinal cord injury, blindness, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, amputation injuries, mental health, and substance abuse and conditions requiring long-term care. In addition, the department trains healthcare personnel, conducts medical research, and serves as backup to the United States Department of Defense, supporting communities in times of crisis. Unfortunately, this agency has been consistently underfunded. A Governmental Accountability Office report in 2005 highlighted the lack of resources and staffing available to the VA for processing an increasing backlog of veterans' claims. Funding for the department lags behind both medical inflation and the increased demand for services. For example, the enrollment for veterans' health care increased 134% between fiscal years 1996 and 2004, yet funding only increased 34% during the same period when adjusted to 1996 dollars. Former Secretary of Veterans Affairs Anthony Principe has publicly stated that the department has been struggling to provide health care to the rapidly rising number of veterans who need it. This resolution expresses the profound gratitude of the Alaska State Legislature for the sacrifices made by veterans who suffer from medical or mental problems resulting from injuries sustained while serving in the United States Armed Forces. More importantly, Madam Chair, it urges the United States Congress to ensure adequate funding for veterans' health care. I ask you to please join me in supporting this resolution. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your statement. Is there any question of Senator Wilkowski at this time? We have quite a few people that signed up to testify on the resolution. All right, it is a very important piece of legislation, so I'll begin with the public testimony that we have. I think they're all online. Rick David Doe?
Madam Chair, President for Vietnam Veterans of America, and I have a panel of the veterans organizations here with us in Anchorage. On my right, I have Ron with Siegels with the Military Order of the Purple Heart.
John Newman
with
Veterans of Veterans Alliance.
We have John Newman from Vietnam Veterans of America here.
This is his letter.
Albo Fong from BVA Chapter 904.
Tim Wheeler with Veterans of Modern Warfare.
Russell Carroll with Vietnam Veterans of
America,
Chapter
904. And Russ is a resurface officer for Vietnam Veterans of America for Alaska.
Excuse me before you continue. Do each one of those people plan to testify individually?
Madam Chair, I don't think so. I think that they're here to express the support. If there are questions, they may want to speak to some of the questions.
All right, thank you. You may continue.
Did you receive a copy of my written testimony, Madam Chair?
I have it in front of me, yes.
Okay. I won't go through and read that. I'll just make a summation comment. This morning I reviewed all 307 bills pending in Congress dealing with veterans' issues. This is the only bill that all nine national veterans organizations have gotten behind in the history of all the nine national veterans organizations. And it's because we have watched over the last 20 years the funding levels for service-connected disabled veterans and veterans per se through the Veterans Administration, he's subjected to partisan rancor as they discuss what is now known as the Department of Defense Construction Budget and Veterans Administration funding. VA funding is, in fact, a subset of the Department of Defense Construction Budget. One of the things that would be done in the passage of a bill before the House now, H.R. 2514, would be separate that out so the VA bill would stand on its own. And as you know, and the members of the committee know, and certainly Mr. Cowdery know, that if you have something that's part of a subset of another bill, it sort of gets the last pieces of the pie. This would move veterans' health care funding to a formula base. The formula is very simple. How many people are enrolled in the VA for services? That means they've gone through a process of being what we call connected for veterans' health care. And how many people are eligible for veterans' health care? Particularly under the existing schedule, any service-connected disabled veteran is eligible for health care. And then retired veterans have other services as well. One of the concerns is some people have said that this would make veterans' health care another welfare program. I say to those people, with all due respect, this is the only health care program in the United States that is based on service, sacrifice, injury, and standing guard for America. So this is health care based on earned benefits, not granted benefits. The legislation has had two hearings in the House, in the Congress. They're working through some technical amendments now, and Vietnam Veterans of America has sort of taken the forefront of the effort to organize states to submit to the Congress and the President a resolution stating that the states, particularly in Alaska, support passage of this bill. Let me give you an idea of what the value of this is. First of all, it doesn't cost the state anything. But the return on this little investment is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. You have a statement from me as chairman of the Alaska Veterans Foundation showing in the specific numbers how veterans generate over $1 billion in annual revenue to the state in revenue and services. That doesn't include active duty military. That doesn't include contracting for Department of Defense activities. According to the 2000 census, we have approximately 75,400 veterans in the state based on retirement and separation. We believe now it's just under 80,000. 80,000 veterans in our state, if each veteran has two members of a family, that represents approximately one-third of the population of our state. These are veterans that earned the right to services from the Veterans Administration. And we think it's time that we take the funding for veteran services out of the Department of Defense Construction Budget, and we take it out of the partisan rancor, and we go to a formula based on enrollment and eligibility. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Rick, for your testimony, and I guess a couple of questions that I've had is, in this day and age, you want to call it modern warfare or terrorism or whatever, there seem to be some specific injuries that the troops suffer, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan, that are not necessarily so different, but probably a greater frequency than existed in past wars. And I see a lot of that and a lot of organizations trying to raise funds, not necessarily for medical care, but for morale of individuals, which is obviously important in rehabilitation. So I don't know if it's particularly a question, but anyhow, a comment that I would make. I find it very objectionable that the United States government has not stepped up to make sure that our troops returning from Iran and Iraq in particular get the care that they need. And I wanted to ask a question to your knowledge. Is veterans insurance generally considered primary, like the state of Alaska's insurance is considered primary? Is veterans insurance primary, or do they allow or privately insured through different employers, maybe primary in the case of a veteran.
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair. First of all, veterans per se do not have veterans insurance. If you're retired military, you have what's called TRICARE health care services, which is effectively a third-party carrier. Most veterans do not access services for the Veterans Administration. Most access their health care through their own employer or their own purchase health care. That's what I do, although I'm 50% disabled and eligible for services with the VA. I don't use it because I can afford my own health care. And that's generally the case. In Alaska, the VA serves less than 20% of our veterans at the VA, although I would say probably closer to 40% of our veterans are eligible for services with the VA. Let me go back to one of your previous comments, Senator, that the Congress and the President have stepped up pretty well to deal with these traumatic brain injuries and some of these unique situations that are tied to the current war. The problem is, if you look at that in an isolated way, that looks very good. But what's actually happened is we pulled money out of other areas of the VA. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of Vietnam veterans sitting around here who will tell you that at the VA, we're sort of the forgotten population now. The guys that are the new vets are getting the priority. The guys that are the new vets are getting the services. And we have nothing bad to say about that. Certainly, we support the hell out of that. But what you have when you're working within, particularly a Defense Department construction budget, is you have exchanges between taking some money out of here and putting some money over there. One of the areas that's been really underfunded is post-traumatic stress programs, particularly for Vietnam veterans, who had an extremely high incidence of PTSD, mainly because, in my opinion, as someone who suffers from that, our communities did not welcome us when we came home, and that healing that's supposed to take place has not, and is just beginning to take place. If you're interested, Senator, in any of the other specific programs within the VA and the funding histories there, I can certainly provide that to the committee. But our interest is to get the funding mechanism for veterans health care out of partisan process into a more formula-based process based on need and based on actual enrollment.
Thank you for the comments. Yes, and I realize it's not insurance per se, but the benefits, the way they're distributed, and I realize there's a lot of moving around of things to try and bridge the gaps here and there, but I'm hoping that, although this is just a resolution, it does urge our congressional delegation. So hopefully you would get me some information, because I would take advantage of the opportunity to discuss with them, you know, some of the areas that are not supported as much as they should be. So I thank you for your testimony, though.
All right, thank you very much. There's a Mr. Yeoman there. Would you like to answer part of that question, or you prefer not to make any comment at this time? I know you used to work over at the Veteran Administration.
Yes, Mr. Davis, how are you this morning?
Just fine this afternoon.
Good. I don't really have a lot to say, but I think that we really need to support this bill and try to put it in place as soon as we possibly can, because there's a lot of us out there. Thank you.
My question to the group that's there, who is the sponsor, or to the sponsor of this resolution? Who is the sponsor of this resolution, of the bill in Congress?
Madam Chair, Rick Davies. Congressman Hare is the principal sponsor. Chairman Filner is the principal co-sponsor. He's the chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee. Chairman Filner and I have had a number of face-to-face meetings about this bill, and he is absolutely committed to get this out this Congress. We have been trying to get a Senate companion bill and have not been successful in doing that yet. Part of that is because of the illness of the former chairman of the Senate committee, and that sort of got shuffled around. But I suspect that sometime this year we'll have a Senate companion bill.
Very good. So at this time, you are pleased with the way the bill is written?
Yes, we are pleased with the way the bill is written. They're dealing with some technical amendments to ensure appropriate congressional oversight in the oversight committees, and where there are some references necessary, that kind of thing. Once that's worked out, we'll get a new copy of the bill, and I'll certainly provide that to you when I get that.
All right. Thank you. That would be helpful. We do have one other person that signed up to speak on this bill. William Goss, would you pronounce the last name?
It's Goswiler, Madam Chair.
Would you repeat that, please?
It's Goswiler, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
You may testify.
Unfortunately, I came in late by the parking space here, and I missed a lot of what Rick David said, but I am a member of his organization, and I am supportive of this bill. It is one of the strongest measures that our organization has been fighting for and has been really trying to get passed for a long, long time. I can't tell you how impassioned we are about protecting our veterans, not just our past veterans, but the ones we worry about coming back from Iraq now. With PTSD, it's a hidden malady that doesn't manifest itself sometimes for many, many years and has terrible results. And I know I'm speaking in generalities here, but I can't tell you how much we are strongly support this bill and are trying to get as much help as we can for our veterans.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, this is Rick Davidge. I'd like just to read off the names for the record of the veterans organizations nationally who support this bill. The American Legion, the American Veterans, or AMVETS, Blinded Veterans Association, Disabled American Veterans, Jewish War Veterans of the United States, Military Order of the Purple Heart, Paralyzed Veterans of America, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and the Vietnam Veterans of America. That
All right.
Makes up the Partnership for Veterans Health Care Budget Reform.
Thank you very much for that information. And back to the chair or the sponsor of this bill, I want to say to you, I appreciate the fact that you have brought this bill before us. I think it's an important piece of legislation that most of us probably could get behind, and I hope that it would pass. The Veterans Administration have a great medical network. The thing is, they just don't put enough money into it. But as far as a delivery system, they have one of the best delivery systems in the United States, and we could learn a lot from it since we are at the present time trying to work on some systems for the state of Alaska. So thank you very much. Is there any other comment from anyone else on the committee? Yes, doctor. Now I've promoted you to doctor. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I apologize for being late, and I'd like the record to reflect that I've been here for about the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, I would say that, yes. Is that all you wanted to say?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you wanted me to recognize you. I'm sorry. We have recognized you then. Thank you very much. Yes?
We do have a representative, the regional director for Vietnam Veterans of America, is visiting Alaska right now, and he's here and has something he'd like to add.
If he'd come forward and give his name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair, my name is John Newman, regional director for the Pacific Northwest, Vietnam Veterans of America.
Okay.
I have just two brief comments that I would like to put in for consideration. That is that every veteran that has ever taken an oath of enlistment enters into a contract with the United States government to serve, just as the United States government enters a contract to fulfill its promise to take care of the medical service and assurances of medical coverage. Where would we be if veterans reneged on their promise? Second point is that health care, mental health care, is still health care. It's care for an illness that has no cure. The only care that we can supply to veterans and fit them for this is teaching them how to cope with their illness. They'll die with it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're quite welcome. Thank you very much. And once again, I just want to come back to Senator Dyson. I'm sorry that I didn't recognize you as soon as you come in, but we were in the middle of the testimony, and then I forgot it. It slipped my mind, but I'm not trying to ignore you, and I thank you for bringing it to my attention. I think that's all the testimony, unless there's somebody in the audience that want to testify on SJR 11. Is there anyone there? Would you come forward, please?
Good Chairman Davis and your staff. My name is Diane Slater. I am a prior military with the Army here, Alaska National Guard and the Washington Guard. And being from the Vietnam era, I have many, many friends who have been in Vietnam, some who have not come back. And my former husband, who was a Vietnam vet, fights very strongly for the vets in North Carolina. And I think that this bill is greatly needed. And I agree with the people who were talking to you about these are people who have earned this health care. And I strongly support this bill as well.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you. Senator Calvi, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still there.
Do you have any question?
No question.
All right, thank you.
I support this bill. Resolution.
All right, thank you. At this time, there's no other public testimony. I'd like to know what the will of the committee is. I'd like to move SJR 11 from our committee to the next committee of referral if it's in agreement with the members that are present.
You looking for a motion?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move that we report SJR 11 out of committee with individual recommendations.
It's been moved that we move this bill out of with individual recommendations. Is there an objection? Hearing no objection, the bill will be moved. The resolution will be moved. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for hearing this so quickly.
You're quite welcome. The next bill that we're going to take up is going to be Senate Bill 231. Now, I think you have a new CS in front of you, which we would like to have you accept. And I'm going to ask my staffer to come down and go over the changes that have been made. And if there's somebody from housing that wants to come up to speak to these changes, they may do that also at the same time that you are presenting. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Don Burrell. I'm legislative aide for Senator Betty Davis. The changes for Senate Bill 231 are as follows. On page 3, lines 16 and 17, per the request of Senator Elton, the words were added, and at least one member who is a consumer of affordable housing. Page 3, lines 23 and 24, what was once a two-year term was changed to a three-year term. And page 4, line 22, the following was added after reducing homelessness. Reducing homelessness and improve employment and vocational training opportunities for the homeless.
And that was the recommendation came from housing?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Is there anything that you'd like to say pertaining to the amendments that we've made to this bill, the new CS?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Public Affairs Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and AHFC is fine with these changes.
All right, thank you very much. Any questions of the members? Senator Calgary, did you hear the report that was given?
Yes.
No questions?
I have no questions.
All right, thank you very much. This is a bill that has been previously heard, and as far as I know from the committees, I think these are the only changes that was asked for, and I'd like to move at this time have a motion on the floor to accept the new CS that we have in front of us.
Yep. Madam Chair.
Yes,
yeah, Senator Dyson. Move that we accept as our working document the backslash C Cook February 108 is our working document.
Yes, thank you very much.
And then I have a question for the this gentleman, if I may.
You may continue.
I may have missed a hearing on this before. The whole subprime housing loan business, you know, that swept the created real problems in our country and in Great Britain makes all of us think about making loans to folks who would not normally qualify for a commercial loan for housing, you know, on pretty time-honored and practical criteria. I'd enjoy some discussion from you about how can we make advantaged loans at less than commercial terms to this population without both exposing them to financial liabilities that they may be ill-equipped to handle and or we, the public, for making loans that are perhaps unwise. Sure. I said that awkwardly, but I'm sure you understand what I mean.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I'll take a shot at that. However, Jeff Jesse from the Mental Health Trust and Dan Fauske, who is the chair of the Alaska Council on the Homeless, are also here as well. The primary intent of this housing trust is to aid the homeless in finding available housing and getting available housing, but I don't know that it's providing mortgages for a homeless person. I mean, that may be something that's a step down the road, but I think that at this point it's just making sure that there's the needed housing to get them from where they are, the dire situation they're in currently, to a situation where they do have housing and they can build towards beginning a job or doing the things that would allow them to one day build to that. And we could certainly discuss, whether at your office or we could discuss here, the subprime crisis and what's going on in Alaska and that kind of stuff, but it's not really directly to what this bill does.
So this bill, if I may, is not aimed at getting presently homeless people into an ownership position in real property.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, that is correct. That may be a down the road thing, but this is more into the immediate helping homeless get into housing, having a roof over their head.
Which, if I may, I assume then is expanded capacity of public housing or subsidized access to privately owned or rental property.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, that is correct. We have approximately 3,000 to 4,000 people on the waiting list for public housing. We simply don't have enough vouchers. We don't have enough units. Jeff Jesse spoke last week about how many of the units we have right now are falling apart. And so not only do we have a shortage of low-income units statewide, but it's getting even worse. And so this part of this will address just making sure we keep what we have, and the other will be to expand it to help the homeless.
Mr. Jesse, would you like to come up? And also, Dan Fauske, is he in the room? If you're interested in coming up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Senator Dyson, to answer your question, Brian, I think, has given you, you know, obviously the right answer. A lot of what the Housing Trust is designed to do is to marry up supportive services with housing. What we find is many people who are homeless are there for a lot of reasons, whether it's substance abuse, domestic violence, mental health issues, other disabilities. And what we've found at the Council on Homelessness is without support services, in terms of case management, counseling, 24/7 crisis ability, even if we get them into housing, they don't maintain that housing. So a lot of what the Housing Trust is designed to do is marry up our housing system with our social service system. As Brian said, at some point, home ownership might become a possibility for some of these individuals, but frankly, in the short run, we're just trying to get them stabilized in housing, bring support services to them, and keep them stable in the community.
And
yes, you may.
I think that's marvelous, and I applaud it. Does this bill have a fiscal note? I don't see one.
There was not one. I don't think there's one.
Through the chair, that's why it's Senator not Dyson, one. It's a zero fiscal note in terms of the council administering the housing trust fund. It would be administered by HFC. There is, however, a $10 million request in the governor's capital budget that goes along with this, and it's in four equal parts: $2.5 million HFC dividend, $2.5 million state general fund, $2.5 million mental health trust receipts, and $2.5 million other sources such as the Rasmussen Foundation and other private organizations that have either already given or shown an interest in giving to the fund.
If I may continue then.
You may.
So am I right in assuming that's $10 million that's going to be used to build additional housing?
No.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, the housing trust will be fairly flexible, but a good example would be, as the Gates Foundation came up last year and testified to, a particular project might have some capital money to buy down the overall cost of the project, so it'll pencil out at people at lower income. It might also have a commitment of 5 to 10 years of social service funding. So a social service provider would be willing to hire, say, a case manager in order to help a group of homeless people stay in housing. It's important that that be committed up front so that if you don't fund the housing trust in future years, those projects can continue for the 5 to 10 year lifespan. And then AHFC has agreed to develop project-based vouchers to help with the rental assistance. So the housing trust won't be the major funder of any particular project. What it will do is take our existing resources and help focus them on the homeless issues that we have, as opposed to now where many of those resources actually go to people at higher incomes.
So, see if I got this. So the $10 million isn't going to build facilities. It is for the people who will help, quote, focus and be the clearinghouse and facilitators that get people and property together.
Yeah, Senator Dyson, through the chair, let me give you an example. I had a developer come in my office a couple of weeks ago. He's about to do a major renovation of about 60 units in Fairbanks. He had not been thinking in terms of having any units focused on the homeless. When he heard about the housing trust, he said, so this means I might be able to get a small amount of additional capital money and a social service partner that would provide support services for homeless people if I got them into a few of these units. And when told yes, that was the point, he was very positive about saying, well, in that case, I might be able to work that into my project. So it wouldn't necessarily be, we don't want large projects focused just on the homeless. We want to integrate them into mixed income projects such as the one this particular developer proposed. That's just one example. There's a lot of different strategies that we think will come forward once we have a resource for people to access.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
This is Senator Cavery.
Yes, Senator, you may speak.
Will this corporation have a sunset date?
There's no sunset date on this, but no, it's not. Not on the present bill that we have in front of us. It's just setting up the Alaska Housing Trust, and there is no sunset date on it. I don't really see the need for one because this is a much needed service. I can't imagine that we would want it to go away in even in 10 to 15 years from now if it's needed.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm generally supportive of the bill, obviously, to try and get homeless off the street, make sure that they retain a place to live. That's important, obviously, and that we try to improve their employment and vocational training opportunities. I think that's great. But I'm looking at a couple of the provisions on page 2, line 7, number 1. I'm not quite sure what that means when we say that we participate, further powers granted, or participate in the development of buildings or units that by their use address the purpose of the fund, which is to create or at least retain housing for folks, but that by their operation appear non-residential in nature. What we don't want them to be office buildings or look like office buildings. I mean, residential is usually pretty easy to identify. What does that mean?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, you may have seen in the Sunday paper, there was an article about Safe Harbor, which is a motel, if you will, in Anchorage, specifically focused on homeless families and individuals. Normally, that's not considered residential for purposes of AHFC. AHFC cannot invest in a motel. And yet, that's a critical strategy to getting homeless families and individuals off the street, get them stabilized, and then move them into long-term housing. So I know this is kind of a convoluted phrase, but that's designed to do. Is a motel doesn't look like, quote, residential, but in fact it is an important strategy in dealing with homelessness.
And one other question, yes. a little bit different, but along the lines of supplying and assisting folks, there always comes the concern that individuals, particularly in some areas, I'm trying to put this tactfully, that there are other problems associated with homelessness, oftentimes drug addiction, alcohol, that kind of thing. The last thing I need to hear is from a constituent saying, geez, you know, we're paying taxes. They may not be paying taxes, but if they're a business or whatever, they consider it. And money that I pay is going to support reduced cost housing and job benefit to individuals that have drug and alcohol problems. I'm asked at my employer to drug test on either some regular reoccurring basis or at least randomly or something. I don't see any language in here. I don't know that I expect to see that in there, but I would hope that we have at least that arrangement. I think I mentioned it before with those that we're participating with on both sides, those providing the housing or apartments or whatever, and those that would be participating in the program or be allowed to participate in the program, that there's some consideration made for those kind of things. Because like I said, I think the last, I don't want to seem hard on this, but the last thing I need is people complaining about how this process takes place, and here down the street from them is a place that concentrates on homeless housing, and the folks that are there are running or at least have a lot of people in and out, and drugs are prevalent on the premises, that type of thing. Bad for the program, obviously. It caused me problems with trying to explain that and how we're trying to deal with it. Hopefully we don't have to deal with it. I really, people are people, that, you know, a certain percentage of people regardless of their economic situation, but I'm hoping that it's something that through the folks that you do business with that is at least addressed.
Well, Senator Thomas, through the chair, that's exactly the point of bringing these support services in, is we don't want to just enable people to continue an addictive lifestyle or have to deal with mental illness or other issues without support. So that's actually the point of this, is to get them that support and hopefully get them, if they are addicted or have other issues like that, get them treatment, get them stable, you know, not have it be party central. Help them learn refusal skills for people that come over and want to party at their place. The problem is now we don't have that. And in fact, if they get housing, many of those things happen, and then they end up losing their housing. The other thing you might tell constituents with that concern is the fact is we pay for them now. We pay for them in the emergency room. We pay for them through the criminal justice system. Homelessness is not free. Homelessness is very expensive to the state. And so if you're going to pay one way or the other, we're better off paying in a way that offers an opportunity for people to break that cycle of homelessness.
And I appreciate those comments, and particularly the last ones, because I do believe that education and these types of programs can be helpful in that. However, telling people that is fine, providing information or documentation that has in fact taken place in other areas is a different thing. So that is helpful. We talk a lot about the intervention and how it saves us money in the long run, and I'm a believer in that. I believe that if you intervene early enough, you may turn some of those folks around, maybe a good portion of them, and you will save in the other social service costs. So I believe in that. I would like to have a documentation where you obviously have discussed that with other folks, probably from other states, that would indicate what kind of impact that did have on overall costs. Anyhow, and I appreciate your testimony and your effort.
I think that I could provide you some of that information. We've had some of the people to come from the Gates Foundation to talk about the program down in Seattle, and I do have that information in my office, and there's other information that can be provided to you. But I'd just like to go on record to say that everybody that's homeless is not going to fall into the category of Bruce's situations, whatever you might think. There are families in need of homes with young children and single mothers and all kinds of people that are in need of a home, and they're not all having that. But it's good that this particular situation that we're looking at now would set up the kinds of things that you're talking about to help those people in the area where they need it, be it social services or should it be mental health or be in any other capacity that they can assist them in would benefit them. And I think your constituents, as well as any constituent, would be glad to know that they're providing that service. It should make them feel safer, and knowing that we're doing the right things for a great number of people that would not be able to do it for themselves. Any other comments or questions? We've heard this bill. This is the second time, and we got our CS before us, in front of us, and I was hoping that we would be able to move this bill out of my committee today. Is there anyone willing to make a motion to move Senate Bill 231?
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I would make a motion that we move the CS for Senate Bill 231 from HES Committee with individual recommendations, and there is no attachment.
You could say zero because it's not one.
Okay. Zero fiscal note. And the zero fiscal note.
Yes. And we'll see that gets with the package before we pass it along to finance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Is there any other things to come before us? We do have one more bill. We'll go now to what? I guess my staff is saying that I didn't ask for a vote on the bill. I hear no objection. I thought it was going to pass. Do you object to this bill going out of committee? There'd be no need to call the roll if nobody object. Thank you very much. We'll go to the next bill before us, which is 233, Senate Bill 233. And this is a bill also that we've heard before. I did bring a CS forward because there was no recommendation for any changes from the sponsor or from the committee folks that I sent out to see if they wanted to make a change in any capacity. Just to give you time to go through the bill, you might want to run over it again for us,
sure.
And then maybe the members will remember that we've heard this before.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, Brian Butcher, Public Affairs Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. This bill does two things. The first thing it does is 5 years ago, by SB 25, a program was established at HFC that would allow teachers and registered nurses to purchase a home without putting a down payment down. And the thinking behind it was that communities were having difficulty recruiting and retaining teachers and RNs, And probably the biggest hurdle of home ownership for young teachers and RNs moving into a community was getting up the money for a down payment. And that if we allowed zero down payment with AHFC continuing to make sure that they met the requirements that they would have to regardless when looking for a mortgage home, that we would have some success with that. There was a sunset date put on it. The sunset will expire July 1st of 2008. The program has been tremendously successful. To date, 373 teachers and nurses have taken mortgages out in 34 different communities across the state at no additional cost to HFC or the state. Out of the 373, there's only been one foreclosure, which is a lower percentage than even our relatively low foreclosure rate for AHFC, and it's just worked splendidly. We would like to remove the sunset date and allow it to be a permanent program, as well as expanding it beyond RNs to include all healthcare professionals that could be of need in different communities across the state.
All right. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Can you give me a kind of a back of the envelope accuracy description of where these homes are?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, there should be an attachment as backup, a list of all the communities since the inception of the program, starting in Anchorage and going alphabetically under the code, and this is just how our mortgage department codes it.
Oh,
under the area, E are teacher loans, H are nurses. So on page one, you can see in Anchorage, there's been 114 teachers loans and 77 nurses loans. You can see the balance, and so you can kind of go through because of the nature of it, the fact that there's simply more teachers and nurses in urban Alaska than rural Alaska, the majority of the activity does take place in urban Alaska. It kind of was seen as a partner a little bit to our rural teacher and health professional loan program that's in our capital budget that works to help build housing units in rural Alaska for teachers and health professionals. And this is something that it is used, as you can see, in the rural areas, but it's primarily more of an urban program.
Yeah, if I may continue. And I had, when we did this, I had no anticipation that it was needed or going to be used on the road network. These are pretty, you know, fairly good paying professions. Why does a nurse need this program in order to be able to get a house on the road network?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, when the program started, we talked to quite a few nurses and teachers that were absolutely thrilled to death to have this program because they said they wouldn't have been able to receive a mortgage normally because they were just out of school, just moved into a community, had a large amount of student loans to pay. The starting salary for these, granted, as the years go on, they make more money and this is less of a concern, but a starting teacher doesn't make a whole lot of money, and yet we felt that it was a risk worth taking in terms of being a professional job and being a job where is needed in the urban areas. Also, the normal amount of mortgage insurance required is 20%. On these, we've required 30% just to make sure the corporation was covered in case there were individuals that would be more inclined to walk away from them. And I think as a result, that's why we've seen out of 373, there's only been one where somebody just picked up and left out of state. And it's been phenomenal, in particular, given this soft market.
All right.
Yeah, so my sense is that this ends up being a sweetener for the job offers, you know, makes the jobs more attractive. And it's quite different than what I anticipated we were doing. And housing for professionals in very rural areas, off-the-road network is a huge crisis, and I'm disappointed that there isn't a lot more here that have taken advantage for that. And an ancillary question that I would have raised if I'd have been here last week was that...
Go on.
We have a huge problem in finding housing for public safety officers, troopers, and VPSOs. Has there been any discussion about expanding a program for the public safety officers?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, yes, there has. The issue the corporation has is because these are unique programs, they're seen by the rating credit agencies as non-conforming loans. They don't fit into the normal categories. As a result, that's weighed more when they're looking at our credit rating than the regular loan portfolio we have. So what we've tried to do is, as an example with this teacher and RNs, we have a history over 5 years to show that they've been performing, to show this isn't a reason why we're more vulnerable and we should be downgraded. We certainly would be open to possibly expanding that at some point, but we hope to do it very gradually because we don't want it expanded to the point where the program has to be done away with because it's simply giving us too much exposure. If I can touch on a couple of the other questions earlier. This program, although it is a zero down payment program, is not giving any, they're not getting a reduction on their interest rate. There's nothing outside of just the regular loan program here. So it's not costing AHFC or the state anything. It's just getting us more business. And what you talk about having to do with the crisis in rural Alaska is absolutely true. And I think that's the reason Dan probably stepped up here. The other half of this, our rural teacher and health professional and public safety loan program that's in the capital budget, has done phenomenally well in getting these units out to rural Alaska. I think it's been 100 and...
We're up. If I may, Madam Chair.
Yes, you may.
Dan Fowsky, CEO of Alaska Housing. I'm fighting a head cold. I've been trying to, as much as I like to talk, I'm for it, I'll start coughing. I think we're up to 221 units on the rural side. We've leveraged $30 million into $50 million in assets. And the two programs work marvelously well together. We identified early on, Senator, in most cases in rural, with itinerant or transient teachers, you're just not going to get into the home ownership phase. Now, the programs are available for those that choose to do that. The biggest problem that was identified a number of years ago in conjunction with the bill you have before you and the subsequent bill that we started on our rural side was identified needs, through the industry, through the school districts, through public safety. I've met with numerous commissioners of public safety. The biggest deal we did was we did a loan and backed a couple entrepreneurs in Bethel and financed a 22-unit state trooper facility that had a tremendous impact on their ability to recruit and retain. We also managed Denali Commission money, so they have asked us to manage their funds. So you have two programs working in conjunction. This program, and your comment on that we don't want it to be a job enticement, we're not seeing much of that. As Brian pointed out with the mortgage insurance, this really helps people that just don't have the down payment. You had accelerating housing costs in the Anchorage Bowl and some of our other urban areas. It became very difficult for young professionals starting out to afford. As far as expanding the program, we watch that very closely. I've met with other commissioners and have asked them to address specific needs to us, and they have in certain cases, and we're working with them. But I think the programs were created to specifically deal with issues that have been raised in recruitment and retention. The public safety side on the other program works very well. So we're open to any ideas. We're just trying to limit it to the point where it's effective, doesn't become this Christmas tree, as they call it, and we end up with something that does exactly what you were fearful of, and it just turns into a recruitment tool. I don't think that would be appropriate.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, this is Senator Calgary.
Yes, Senator Calgary.
I was wondering if this program could be expanded, or is there any thought of being expanded to include construction and labor workers who apprenticeships, stuff like that, who don't have a lot of a large income.
Through the chair, yes. Senator Cowdery, if I've heard that request before, I apologize. I forgot. We haven't heard on construction workers, VPSOs at the village level or one. Your suggestion is not a bad one, but we haven't been approached in regards to that specific clientele.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, my guess is what Senator Cowdery was talking about is, has the construction of the facilities been tailored to be used for training apprentice, and particularly apprentice craftsmen in rural areas, so that we get the double benefit of training people in an area where there's a lot of joblessness, and as well as getting the housing. Am I right, Senator Cowdery?
Yes, that was partly, but I was also, you know, we have a lot of apprentices that work around the state that just don't have a large yearly income. And I was wondering if any consideration for that segment of our society.
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, that kind of falls into what we were talking about expanding at anything at this point beyond teachers and healthcare professionals, and that we had to, even discussing going from RNs and expanding it a little bit to healthcare professionals, we had to spend a lot of time with our finance department talking to the, you know, Standard & Poor's and Moody's and the rating agencies and other people, trying to figure out, in particular in this current environment, we don't want to do anything that would risk our credit rating that could end up costing us more money for bonds, costing Alaskans more money for their homes. So we've been very hesitant at this point until we've got an opportunity to kind of be able to look back and show the rating agencies that this is a program that is producing, this is a program that isn't going to put us at higher risk of having foreclosures.
All right, thank you.
If I may, to
yes,
add
you may.
Through the chair to Senator Dyson, there is an absolute priority on these projects for local hire at the village level with some training where appropriate. We also, rather than run full-scale training through a project to try, what ends up happening then is that the costs go to such phenomenal or can, and then the square footage costs start troubling us because people go, good grief, costs a lot to build these. You see, because people forget about the training pretty quick. And but we have a good relationship with Denali and ourselves and local contractors, local school boards, local village corps, and others to make sure that as much local hire is attainable as possible. And we've got a great record going with how that's working and continuing.
All right. Thank you for that information. Yes, Senator Dyson?
Yeah. Dan, you said something in passing here that intrigued me. I raised the question about housing for public safety folks, and you came back and said, you know, in essence, it's a problem for folks who are assigned to an area for a relatively short period of time, a 2 or 3 year hitch or whatever, including teachers and some of the health workers. And then you said in Bethel, I think you said that you worked, I think you said, with a private developer and developed a 22-unit thing. So the Alaska Housing has, in essence, helped bootstrap a private developer who has come up with this housing. That this housing is providing housing for, I suspect, more than troopers, maybe corrections people as well, and that works pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Can we do that in any village in order to have good housing for particularly village public safety officers and troopers and parole probation guys, you know, to take care of the kind of the transient nature of some of those assignments?
Well, absolutely, through the chair, Senator Dyson. We encourage at every level, for instance, one in the rural areas, they might want a fourplex in Quethluck or Hooslea. They also have a need for itinerant For, let's say, teachers, the fourplex, but they also have a need for health care, and we always encourage them to make sure that they've talked to the village public safety or others, because you might want to build a sixplex or an eightplex.
Yep.
Then you get the economy of scale working, and we've had some success doing that, because sometimes things pencil better. You also bring another viable source of income onto the project, because that state trooper or that VPSO or that itinerant health care worker is an employed individual that can help these programs pencil out. So it's an active part of the program as we pursue this.
And it's not affected in positively or negatively by this piece of legislation before us?
No. Okay. Through the chair, Senator Dyson, we will be bringing the other program to you in the capital budget overview. So we'll get an opportunity. We'll get your office a copy of all the communities, and we'll get an opportunity to kind of flesh that out whenever we start capital budget overviews.
All right, and I will be talking to Walt between now and when this one hits finance, and that one does as well, see if he agrees with what you guys have told me.
Okay.
And I appreciate it. And I appreciate what you've done. Sounds like pretty creative solutions. I don't want to find out that rural needs for housing have not had an opportunity because too much money has gone to ones on the road network and stuff.
We think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
All right.
May I indulge? I'm glad he asked that. I just like to just take a moment to toot our own horn a little bit. We realized or recognized a long time ago, and I'm just going to grab a number and say, someone wants a six or an eightplex and it costs $1 million and it's in remote Alaska, and we did our analysis and we realized that it penciled at $700,000, meaning based on the salaries being paid, they could only afford $700,000. Now that puts you into the unconventional mode, meaning, okay, you either raise salaries or subsidize in some capacity, or you're never going to get to a conventional strategy. So the theory that we put in place was, we've analyzed it, they're good construction numbers, this is not some exorbitant pie in the sky. It costs $1 million, pencils at $700,000. We want to write a check for the $300,000. We'll do that out of corporate cash that comes through our capital budget that you see. And in that $700,000, we have unlimited access to capital, and that's Wall Street. Because now we can take that and roll it into our normal operations. And so that was a theory. And at first, school boards and the legislature very graciously helped us. Yeah, you can borrow money. And so the other part that I really like about it is it's a loan. So in other words, when you folks pass the school foundation funding formula and the money goes out, we're tapping into that resource, because in that money are salaries and expenses and other things that are the normal course of business. And we wanted to figure out a way to leverage that through Wall Street and other facilities and get the best bang for the state dollar, and it's working marvelously well. So you send the money out, we tap into it through school boards or village corps or others. On the entrepreneurial side, we prefer private ownership. We don't own any of this, and we remove ourselves from direct relationship with the contractors. We want to deal with school boards or others. We don't want to get into any type of image that it doesn't look appropriate. So, and we also want to have local support. We don't want to go out and tell them what we might like them to come to us and say, we're the village councils have met, or the assembly or whoever, and they fully support this, and then we go forward, and it's been working real well.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I want to make it clear that we're obviously talking about two different bills here, or potentials, because this one says owner-occupied single-family housing. So, you know, the other aspect, the entrepreneurial aspect of it, is a whole different situation. But my concern is one that was mentioned a little bit earlier. I too, even though I wasn't here when the bill was when bills were originally passed regarding these types of loans, I look at it more as an incentive for people living or doing service in remote areas. I'm a little concerned about the aspect of it in Anchorage and Fairbanks and the other urban areas, because it appears to be, even though beginning teachers and nurses are not the highest paid folks, their average income is higher than a whole lot of other folks. And so there was some discussion, I believe, at the last meeting about a financial or income limitations and that type of thing. And I'd certainly like to see that explored, because I don't know what a beginning teacher starts at, but I would I would think that it's above the median income for the state of Alaska. Maybe not, but it's got to be pretty close. So that seems to me another reason for people to complain about what government's doing, and the only justification for it, in my mind, is to encourage people into those occupations, which are sadly needed in the state, and probably more needed in the rural areas. So it's just a concern I have that people say, well, what about the insurance company down the street? They have workers starting at $25,000 a year, and they may be eligible for some loans, but I'm not aware of. So if nothing else, if I was aware that there are loans for folks like that, I could say, well, they get another program working someplace, not necessarily the state, but federal government or whatever. But it is a bit of a concern, because it appears that you're favoring people in a particular job occupation versus others, and not necessarily based on need is what it amounts to. So, anyhow.
Madam Chair, if I may, it's yes, Senator Thomas. Again, going back to 5 years when this bill, there had been an identified need that the corporation was approached on through it, and that Senator Wilkins' office at that time, to try and address this issue of teachers and health professionals to recruit and retain. So that's where it came. At the time, there were a couple of hearings where a great many people wanted to keep adding on to this, to more professions, and at that time it was decided, no, let's give it a test run, see how it works, and thus the sunset provision was put in place to see how the project worked. We have not had a run of doctors, for instance, that use this program. Most people of more affluent, if you will, loans not attractive to them with the mortgage insurance requirement. They'd rather put money down and lower their costs, because until you get to that 70-30 or 80-20 loan to value ratio, they're paying mortgage insurance. But we watch that, and I understand the concern that we don't want to get into a free lunch, if you will, for those that can afford more. Starting salary for teacher it might be more than the median, but it's not a whole. And as I testified earlier, and as Brian had, biggest problem people run into is at the affordability side with the down payment money. That's the enticement of the 100% loan to value. Other states are doing it as well for teachers and nurses just across the country to try, and because they're getting to have such shortages some places, because people can't afford to live where they work. And we're a far cry from what places like San Francisco and major urban areas, you simply cannot live where you work. So thankfully we're not at that, but we do have a problem with, someone starting out at $38,000 a year. The average cost of a new home in Anchorage is $329,000.
Right.
That's tough to make that math work, mm-hmm, with a down. So.
And those $50,000 in loans, student loans.
Yeah.
So. All right, thank you for your information. There is one person signed up to testify on this particular legislation. Melissa Stone?
Senator?
Yes?
This is Senator Chaudhry. I'd like, yes, to Senator, find out what is the salary that we're talking about today? How much per year of the nurses and
people? I could let them speak to them, but there's no cap on the salaries. And are you talking about beginning salaries, or are you talking about?
Well, the people who would utilize this
would qualify.
So he wants what the average salary range is for, yeah, a starting teacher. I could get that.
Would you repeat your question again, Senator Calgary?
I wondered the salary range that we're talking about here for people. If somebody's making $200,000 a year, I suppose they wouldn't qualify, but somebody who is making less, what is the range that we are trying to work with?
Would you like to speak to that?
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Calgary. As we've looked into this, we have realized that looking at other states' programs, that when you're looking at a zero down payment program, the people that benefits the most and take most advantage of the program are folks that don't have the money for the down payment, which is what we're looking at, and also people that look for it as investment properties, looking to try to get as many as possible. Well, this is owner-occupied, so you would not be able to do, it could not be used for an investment property here. So that would just leave folks, in most cases, that didn't have the down payment, because as Dan spoke to just a moment ago, if you made $200,000 a year and you could afford a down payment, it wouldn't be cost effective to use this program, because you'd be paying a lot more in mortgage insurance than you would if you had a down payment. Also, you would have the opportunity to shop anybody you wanted for an interest rate, and in almost all circumstances you could probably find lower interest rates than we have. In this case, you'd be tied into our particular interest rate because we're the ones that have the program. So I know I spoke with Senator Elton about this a little bit after the meeting last week, because he had brought that up, and we said we certainly would be happy to discuss putting an income limit on it, but we didn't feel it was necessary because we really don't think there'd be any highly paid people probably taking advantage of this program, because in the long run it would cost them far more than the possible advantage of not having to put a down payment down.
It would cost them more, you say, if they were, even if they bought a piece of property and put $100,000 down, it still cost them more? Wouldn't that be the cost being based something on the amount of the loan that was involved?
Well, if I may, Madam Chair, Senator Cotter, if someone has $100,000 to put down on a house, I think Brian touched on the most important issue. They're going to go in some conventional program. They're going to do a variable rate. They're going to do something where they're lowering their interest cost probably more than we can do on a program of this nature. I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's not likely that people will do it. I am not aware of any instances where this is occurring, where people are utilizing the program, if you will, to capture this money. As we've stated earlier, with nothing down, you're into the mortgage insurance issue, which drives your monthly costs up, and usually people that have $100,000 are looking at places to invest that money where they can earn money on it and not have it going out the door in terms of an insurance payment. I understand your concern. I can't address it in specifics in that we just haven't seen this occurring, to my knowledge.
Okay, but thank you very much.
You're right, welcome, sir. You. We can certainly look at the salary, get some more detailed information if that would be the desire.
I would appreciate that.
Actually, as far as the teacher's salary, we could easily get that for him if he needs to have that. It doesn't have to be done by housing. Could provide that for him. Once I get back to my office, we could get that information for him. I do have one person that signed up to testify on this bill. Melissa Stone, are you still here?
Yes.
Did you plan to testify?
I would just like to support the bill.
Okay. Would you come put that on record?
For the record, my name is Melissa Stone. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health for the Department of Health and Social Services. And again, I want to support adding healthcare professionals to this bill. We have approximately 29% of all estimated vacancies in the state in the healthcare profession. And for behavioral health folks, that's 22% in the rural area and 9.3% vacancy rate in the urban area. So this has strong potential to help us with recruitment retention.
All right, thank you. Any question of Melissa Stone? No question. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that want to speak to this bill? Is there anybody online that might want to speak to this bill? I did have a note that was written down here at the last time we heard this bill. And the one concern that came out of it was that there might be a possible income limitation for people that would be using the service. And I do know that you spoke with the senator that's not present, Senator Elton, on that after the meeting was over. And he seemed to have been satisfied with what you discussed with him. And so therefore, you did not give any recommendation for the change to be made, and therefore another CS was not prepared. Because I'm not interested in it only if my members are interested in having a limitation put on this bill. And you tell me to move in that direction, I will consider putting it in here, but from my standpoint, I don't see it's necessary. So if we want to hold the bill to have something else drafted, I want to know what I'm holding it for so that I know what to work on. Otherwise, I'd like to move this bill out of my committee. So am I hearing from the people that are present that they want income limitation to be added into this bill?
Madam Chairman, do you need a motion, or can I make a motion to move the bill?
I'm not ready for the motion just now, but I would need a motion to move it. But I'm trying to get a feel for if there's additional information that's needed to do another CS, to do a CS on this bill. Yes, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't know that I necessarily need the financial or the income limitations. It sounds like people believe that it's self-limiting, and just the financial aspect of it, that if somebody is going to involve themselves in this, I see you've made a lot of loans, so I'm not quite sure how that works out. If people are making enough money, then I think they would go ahead and buy regardless of what the circumstances are, because of not only the mortgage insurance, but just the amount of money you're paying on the 100% versus the 80%. So if you have the down payment, which is the case that they don't. So I understand that. Also, I guess it concerns me a little, or not necessarily concerns me, but the concept of I'm not quite sure how to put it. Just the narrow use of it, I guess, is probably best in the long run. I realize there's a need there. People would probably rent, which would be cheaper than this alternative, unless houses get extremely prices come way down. As far as you're talking about Anchorage, the median price of a house in Anchorage is beyond the realm of what we're talking about. So if people are buying those houses and using this program, you're talking about $4,000 a month payments and more, and that doesn't at least match with what we're talking about are the ones that do make use of the program. So I guess I don't need, as long as I have your assurance that, you know, this is being taken advantage of by relatively new people into the various industries, the two industries anyhow, and that it is not something that would be at a later date shown that it is advantaging people in those two industries that are highly paid or compensated. So if that's the understanding, then I don't really have a problem with, you know, taking the time to go through, gather more information, and put some kind of limitation on it.
Okay, and I'd like to add to your comments that this bill goes to finance, and if they are interested in looking at that and considering a limitation on it, that's the place to do it. I think we've done everything that we need to do in health and social services on this bill. So with that, I would entertain a motion to move Senate Bill 233 out of this committee.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a motion to move this bill forward to the next committee of recommendation with individual recommendations.
And there is no physical note with this bill also, so with individual recommendation, he said?
Yes.
All people that are present, are you willing to vote yes on this?
Yes.
Thank you very much. That takes care of 233.
Thank you.
We did quite a bit of work today, and I appreciate you being here, all the one online and the three of us that's present. At this time, we will adjourn. 5 minutes to 4:00.